Love laid bare.
Sharing the highs and lows of stories that matter to you. One conversation at a time. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are through to another episode of Love Laid Bare. How have we been this week, guys? What did you think of last week's episode? You know, as always, hit me up in the DM, send me an email, lovelaidbare@gmail.com. So guys, you know, this platform is all about facing your traumas and actually dealing with them. You know, I feel like we could all be better people, we could all, you know, achieve a lot more things in life if we didn't have a lot of these traumas hanging over us. So as a result, you know, I get really excited when I have like psychotherapists and counselors on the platform, and I have none other than Esther from Frontline Therapy with me today. Welcome, Esther. How are you?
Thank you. I'm very well. I'm glad and honoured to be on your show today.
I'm glad and honoured to have you here.
Likewise.
So tell us a bit about yourself. Okay, how about we start with this? Give us a random like fact about you.
Well, we were talking about this earlier. I don't wear bras, people. I don't wear bras. Remember people asking me that? That's the only random one that people go, wow. Because I can't think that far, so I don't wear bras. I wear it on special occasions. I don't know my bra size, unfortunately. I do have to get to know that. But yeah, that would be a random fact about myself.
Yeah, you know when you start having babies, you're probably going to have to start wearing a bra.
That's the thing. I'm just hoping that gravity doesn't work on me like that.
I'm more talking about like the leaky boobs.
Oh yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah. I've seen that. It's kind of not nice, you know, that stickiness. No. Yeah, I'm going to wear a bra then. I can't be having that.
You're going to have to wear the pad.
Yeah.
To kind of soak up the milk and stuff like that.
Oh
yeah.
Gosh,
It's so funny. Like, I really didn't think you were going to say that. Because as I... But before I start the interview, guys, what I do is I take some pictures, do some video recording. And I was like, oh, let me do like a lengthways one. She's like, no, in my work clothes. I was like, okay, we'll stay seated and I'll do. And then, so I took a picture with the flash on. And I was like, yeah, I can't use this one because I can see your boobs through your top.
Oh, gosh.
But I'm just, you know what? I can't not wear a bra, guys. So, you know, More power to you, Esther.
Thank you.
I'd probably get arrested if I went out to work without a bra. Ooh. Ooh, child.
Oh, God.
So I've invited Esther here today because I wanted to give the listeners an idea of what happens in a therapy session.
Mm-hmm.
Like we discussed off air, it's still very much a stigma associated with having counselling or therapy.
Yeah.
People automatically think that they're crazy, mm-hmm. or you're implying they're crazy, or someone might call you crazy.
Yeah.
So today I just want to kind of break down what happens in a session, you know, what kind of things actually might warrant someone actually seeking therapy and that type of thing. Mm. So, I mean, you guys know, I talk about it all the time. I've had in my lifetime, and I'm in my mid-30s now, so in my lifetime, I've had probably 3 bouts of therapy myself. So when I was 19, it was free. So I went to Off the Record in Croydon, and I went there to have counselling for like self-esteem issues. Not that anything particularly was going on, but I just thought, well, it's free, why not, kind of thing. And I had a white male counsellor, which at the time I thought was, you know, you kind of get what you're given, essentially, if that makes sense. And I did learn something from it, I'll say, but I didn't do it for long. I think you had like 6 weeks or something like that. So I think I went to like maybe 4 of the sessions. Following that, I had psychotherapy after a very violent attempted robbery at my home, which involved, you know, some gunmen and balaclavas and kicking down my front door. So that really, really shook me up. You know, I was afraid to... because this happened in the winter, so I was afraid to, like, once it got, like, to 4 o'clock and it was dark, I was petrified, so work allowed me to leave work early. Mm. If I saw somebody in a hoodie, you know, I would start to feel frantic. Mm. I remember there was one time, I'm laughing now because I can't, but I remember one time I was in Tesco and I was certain that this guy in a hood was following me because he was one of the three guys that, you know, came to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, I was a mess for a few months. So I had psychotherapy to kind of get me through that.
Mm.
And that worked wonders. I mean, now I can sit here and not say it's funny, but at least now I can sit here and kind of be like, I'm okay with that now.
Mm.
And I often wonder, had I not had therapy for that particular thing, God knows what could have kind of happened as a result, you know, to me mentally, because it did affect me quite badly.
Yeah.
And then my last bout of therapy finished last year. And I was in therapy for about a year. And my reason, I'll tell you guys a story. I don't think I've told you guys a story before. But my reasoning for going into therapy was that I was on Twitter one day. And someone had posted this blog and it said, is Beyonce in an emotionally abusive relationship? And I was like, oh my God, you people write about anything. Oh, this is nonsense. And then, but I felt compelled to read it because I just wanted to kind of throw lemons and tomatoes at it, like virtually. And then I read the article, well, the blog, and I was like, is Beyonce in an emotionally abusive relationship? I wasn't aware that continuous infidelity was a form of emotional abuse. And then I was like, wow, I'm in an emotionally abusive relationship. And I had no idea. And for me, that was kind of like the light bulb moment. And then there was a book attached, I can't remember what it's called, but I'll put it in the blog, guys, but there was a book attached to it called Why Does He Do That? I can't remember the name of the guy that wrote it. Basically, he basically had like 30 or 20 years experience of sitting down and speaking to male abusers in all their various different forms, so whether they be physical, financial, emotionally abusive men. So he had spent a lot of time speaking to these men in therapy sessions and stuff like that, and he put together this book. And I was like, wow, okay, so this is actually real, because this now explains, because I think one of the things he said was, is that sometimes women who have been through relationships where there's been consistent infidelity, they can start to act like women who have been in domestically violent relationships. And I was like, oh my God, this is me. So that's my reasoning for having my last bout of therapy. And you know, during that journey, I learned so much about myself. I remember one of the key things, I guess, I remember my therapist saying to me one time was that I didn't love myself. And I was like, how dare you? You don't know what you're talking about. Obviously, I didn't say it in front of her, obviously. I waited until, like, I got in the car. What's she talking about? She doesn't know nothing. I love myself. And it's not until the next day when I, you know, as you do in a therapy session, it kind of sinks in and you're like, shit.
Yeah.
Actually, so that was my kind of final bout. So I've always been very open to therapy. I've never seen any shame or stigma attached to it. I'll quite happily tell people that I've been, but obviously a lot of people aren't like that. So, you know, what is your experience when you, I guess, let me rephrase that. What do you feel like is the main reason why people are so kind of anti talking therapy?
I got asked this question in another podcast, and I think I flipped it, because you get the usual stigma of the usual factors that we say, particularly in the Black and Asian community, of, oh, it's, you know, there's a stigma attached to it, taboo, we, you know, we're told don't talk about our feelings and emotions. And even though we would say our white counterparts are still more open to it, I think still overall it's just not something people do as much depending on the environment or context that you were brought up in. Because it's not understood. You know what it is going to a GP. By 5 or 6, you've gone to a GP once or twice. You know what it is to see a nurse.
Yeah.
We don't really know what it is to speak to somebody about our lives, our feelings, our emotions. It's not indoctrinated, not in a bad way. It's not taught to us from children. It's something that you hear someone's going to a shrink or someone has a breakdown, they're speaking to somebody. So it's always in the context of a major crisis. It's always in the context of the person's unable to cope. So they need a third person in. And it's always something shrouded in mystery.
Mm-hmm.
One, because you don't necessarily, it's I guess ethically, it's one of those things that you can't really film a psychotherapy, like a genuine one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people do, but overall, you don't see. But you can film a GP appointment. Now, you've seen what you can go to in physical health nurse when you do sex ed. You see it. So you have more visual representation mm-hmm. of what psychotherapy, what other forms of health interventions are. But with psychotherapy, you don't know, am I just going to speak to somebody? Am I going to lie on a couch?
Yeah.
You know, so I think just generally there's a mystique to it. So that doesn't help the already stigma attached to speaking to somebody. The fact that society tells us, generally speaking, that, you know, you need to get over things either quite quickly or you just got to deal with it yourself. Or you just can't really trust people with your feelings as well. Because you've got to think about,
yeah.
you also are trusting someone with sensitive information. With other factors as well, then you can talk about the black community or even the Asian community. They have the differences between the black community. I think they all contribute. So I think rather than just specifying the black community, I think therapy itself is a misunderstood intervention because it's not something we're taught from young to mm-hmm. see as normal and understand. It's not something you watch on TV, or when you do watch it on TV, it's the person that had a breakdown, or it's the person that's Lulu or Cray Cray.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. those are the associated images with therapy. So naturally then when you're older and you say you're going therapy, like, what's wrong? Like, what happened? There has to be something major that
yes,
happened
yes,
for
yes,
you
yes,
to
yes.
go. Rather than just want to do a checkup. I go to the GP for a checkup.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I just go and see a therapist for a checkup, you know? So I would say, coming from that angle, added with the factors that we've, you know, I'm sure you've talked about on your podcast and many of us know, contributes to the reason why therapy is still yet something that's elusive and it's like, okay, I'm not sure about that.
Mm.
But I think that's breaking down more and more. But I think that's probably one of the reasons, or one of the key reasons in my head, I think.
Mm-hmm. People that come to, I guess, sessions with you, are they ordinarily willing participants, or do you sometimes have to go through a process of maybe trying to break people down before they're prepared to kind of open up?
In my experience, 90% has to be some sort of willing. It just won't work if you're not willing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 10% is maybe they got told for court they've got to do something.
Right.
You know, there's reasons that look good for them to say that they're trying to yes. change their behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
But 90%, even if they're ambivalent, even if they don't believe they can change or how it can help them, there's a level of willingness because, one, if you're paying money,
mm-hmm.
you're taking up yeah. your time. Even if you're not paying, you're taking up your time talking to somebody. So there has to be a level of willingness, or, you know, we're going to be in a room and it's like I'm pulling water out of a stone. So there has to be a level of willingness. But then there could be willingness and lots of defences.
Okay.
That then mean that you're pulling water out of a stone because that person has become a rock. That person has lifted up their walls. And as long as they are willing to remain in that uncomfortability, because it is uncomfortable when you're kind of loosening the walls, rather than, because mm-hmm. I don't like the word of breaking down.
Yeah.
Because breaking down sounds like you're putting the hammer and smashing it. Mm. No, because those defences saved your life. Those defences were there to protect you at one time.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not necessarily appropriate or adaptive for the environment that you're in now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But some of them can be good. If you have 3 or 4 family members that passed away at the same time, it's important for you to feel the emotions, but maybe at that point you can't cry because you have to make sure that your children are okay.
Okay, yes.
So again, defences are not all bad things. It's just about understanding why they are there and ensuring they don't block you from actually processing your feelings properly.
Mm-hmm.
But some people's defences are really, really high. So that can be seen as someone seeming resistant.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as they come in every week and they're being consistent, that's willingness.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't gonna come, you ain't gonna pay if there isn't a level of wanting something.
Yeah.
You're gonna eventually drop out. Mm-hmm. You're gonna see, what's the point of this?
Do you see a kind of a difference in terms of people's willingness based on their culture or gender as well?
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's still therapy is seen as a middle class thing, a white middle class thing. Within therapy training, it's usually white females, followed then by maybe males, and then black people. You're probably gonna get more black females than black males. Then you would see that also coming into the room, you will probably get more, depending on the area, of white females, white males, followed then by black females, and then black males will probably be last. Asian people, I think, is an interesting one. I think out of the black and Asian, and I could be wrong, so anyone in the, you know, that listens to this, please comment and tell me if I'm wrong, but I would say that Asians are actually probably more unlikely to go therapy than any of the ethnic groups that we're talking about.
Interesting. Why is that?
Because their culture is a very heavily factor into that. So when I say Asian, of course I'm talking about the Chinese, you know, and South Asian, which is India, Pakistan. Because of their culture, you know, we might think in the black community we're anti-talking, but in the Asian community, it's very a close community. And you can just tell just by the way they act. They're always together.
Yeah.
It's a very close community. Maybe their faith has something to do with it in terms of that, you know. Buddhism is very much about you as a person, the mindfulness, you know. I don't know if it says you shouldn't talk to person, because lots of, you know, China and stuff, Japan, like Buddhist, and then you've got Islam, which I guess similar to other faiths could be interpreted to be like you only go to the imam or you only go to the pastor, you know, you only keep it within the family structure. But I think because they've got a very collective type culture, naturally it's like, why would I go out? Literally, you're going from your grandparents, cousins, to maybe an elder, all the way outside.
Outside, you know, where
within the black community, depending on what country you're from, but generally speaking, unfortunately, those structures have been broken down. You know, we haven't got elders in the community unless you're from a particular culture group like Nigeria, Ghana, Uganda, but overall it's a black community. We haven't got that. So if you ain't speaking to your mum or dad, maybe friends, the only other person is a third party. So I think the lines of, I don't know what you'd call them, the points that you have to go through are less within the black community. You know, where I think in the Asian community, it's like, okay, you can't speak to parents, you've got siblings, you can't speak to siblings, you've got cousins, aunties, you know.
Yeah.
They've got that such culture that is like, then you were gone past all of these structures in place to go outside. So that's what I say, but I definitely think it would be great to hear from an Asian therapist, but I've been told by Asian therapists they don't get that many Asians, like,
really?
As much.
Okay.
It's not like they get more blacks and whites than they would get Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Asians would be the least to enter therapy, but they are doing definitely more as well. The millennials are definitely coming into therapy more.
Okay. Do you think there is somewhat of a, maybe danger is too strong of a word, but for those maybe seeking counsel, you know, from, you know, maybe their pastors or within their faith groups who maybe don't actually have the, I mean, they may have the experience in terms of talking to people, but I mean, I have the experience of talking to people and I'm not qualified, right? But do you think there is a danger of people relying on people in their faith groups to seek counsel from rather than seeing a qualified therapist?
I find this such an interesting question. I think it's important that all faith leaders, if they themselves are not mentally health trained, have people on staff or have people on hand if it's some of the members mental health trained. So I think it's not necessarily, I think it's about knowing your expertise. A mental health professional, unless maybe they're a pastor as well, is not attuned to maybe spiritual matters. So if someone comes with spiritual matters, yes, therapists do deal with that, but it might be more akin that is dealt with their spiritual leader. Though, you know, it can connect with, you know, their entire life. Likewise, pastor and mom, although you can't really disconnect spiritual with your life, there'll be aspects of it that might need to be managed in the context of whether it's a psychotherapist or psychiatrist or whatever type of medical professional or mental health professional you go through. So I would say it's all about expertise, and if you see the person as a holistic body, I like to say body, spirit and soul, therefore each needs to be catered to. So spirit, whatever spiritual leader you have, then body, you know, that could be medication, or that could just be exercise, that could be whatever physical thing that you take. And then psychological, which is the soul, which is your mind and your emotions and your will. So I think if we see it like that, people have their place. So pastors have an incredible place. Imams have an incredible place within their community. Also, psychotherapists and mental health professionals have an incredible place also in the community. So there shouldn't be an against, it should be we work together for that person.
Yeah.
I think each person should have all of those things happen at the same time. Wouldn't it be amazing if you had, if your pastor and then your mental health professional, whether you took medication or your physical health, all working together to make you, make your mental health, well-being, emotional, well-being, optimum. That's what it's about. Like you give your children all types of protein. We need that protein, carbohydrates. It's the same thing. We need all of those foundations in life. So rather than seeing them separated or divided or against, they should work together. So yes, I do agree with you. We shouldn't over rely on either. I think it could be not right to over rely on your psychotherapist. I think that's the only thing that can fix you. Likewise, it would be unwise to do so in the spiritual context, and the same just on solely on medication. So I think they have to work together. It might be.
Absolutely. Right. So often you hear comments, I can only speak about church because, you know, but sometimes you often hear comments of, you know, if someone's struggling with their mental health, you know, if they have depression, anxiety, you know, they're often told, you know, just leave it to God, leave it to Jesus, just you just keep praying. Why, in your opinion, do you think churches aren't actively trying to, you know, maybe push their congregation into actually getting an expert involved in stuff like that?
It's interesting. Mental health is not understood. So even now, it's just not an understood thing. There's, if you research mental health, you're going to find different narratives and beliefs. You're going to find people that believe it's a disease model. It's a disease. It's something you can't control. You're going to have people that say it's a narrative. It's a response to trauma. It's a response to things. It's not a disease. The way it's been managed is actually making it worse, you know. So if the world in general is not understanding that, it's not going to be surprising, unfortunately, that our churches are not understanding that as well. Likewise, we encourage, by the way, guys, I am a bit long-winded, but I will get to the point. By the way, we do encourage, you know, black people to get more into science and research. It's the same thing. We need more Christians in research and understanding mental health or any type of disease. And that's why I want to definitely do my study further in that. So I think with lack of understanding, that is the problem. If you don't understand something, you can only give what you understand. So you would just say to someone, do X, Y, Z, and not think, actually, seek help. Also, I think it's a distrust. The pastors may not know what is going on. Like, you know, there's a level of distrust to mental health professionals as well. And I'll be really, really honest with you. Working in mental health on the front end, there is a distrust from them to religion. Just generally speaking, individuals in there may have faith, but there's just a general sense, because a lot of people that present with psychosis sometimes go into what they call religious ideation or paranoia. So they'll start quoting Bible scriptures or the Quran scriptures. So I think already it gives a negative sense. There is a sense. Some psychiatrists, mind you, might even get concerned when a client starts going to church because they think, oh my God, the person's relapsing. So there's distrust on both ends. You know, there's distrust on both ends. So it's, I think that there isn't enough working together. And I think to answer the question about praying about it, I said it to my friend, you know, what do you mean by pray about it? And what does the person understand about praying about it? So a lot of people don't know how to pray anyway. So now they've got an added mental health problem. They're trying to deal with it. What does that mean to pray about it? Pray about it isn't just saying, God, take it away. Praying about it is a bit like what CBT talks to you about, challenging your thoughts, looking at the scriptures and saying to yourself, this is what God says I am, but this is how I feel I am, which is true. Oh, I believe God. Then what does CBT tell you to do? You have to repeat the truth. You have to repeat, I am beautiful. Mm-hmm. I am wonderful. I am worth it. You have to do that habitually so that it can be, you're changing your neural pathway. You're actually changing the structure of your brain from neuroplasticity. That's what we're learning. So that is what prayer is. Prayer mm-hmm. isn't saying, God, I don't want to be depressed tomorrow. Wake up. Oh, crap, I'm depressed. That's not what prayer mm-hmm. is. Prayer is an active pursuit to see yourself in the image the way God sees you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really what I think pastors hopefully should be really saying to the congregation, is seek God until you see his face and you see what he sees in you, rather than, oh, I'm just praying for this to go away.
Well, yeah.
And then in that is also about going therapy, because that, you know, some people do instantaneously get healed of maybe depression. They just stop feeling depressed. But to manage those thoughts, it comes from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, manage those feelings, manage those triggers. Negative thoughts, for some reason, play in our minds more than positive ones. Yes. We all know mm-hmm. that. So you have to take more effort to say, take that away. I'm not stupid. Mm-hmm. I'm not worthless. But we like to sometimes think about that, that think, feel, behave. You think about it, you feel it, you're going to act it out. So we have to catch it when we think about it. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. But it's also now led me onto another question. As we're talking about spirituality as well as therapy. Now, for example, within the church, and I guess particularly, you know, maybe Pentecostal churches, there's a lot of talk on, you know, demons and maybe people being possessed and stuff like that. I mean, I'm asking a question that you might not be able to answer, but I guess as a therapist, if someone comes to you and says, you know, my church is saying that I'm possessed, or I've got demons in me, or demons are trying to ruin my life, how do you manage that? Because that's like, you don't want to necessarily rubbish someone's spirituality and their beliefs, but at the same time, yeah, what do you do?
First, I guess it depends if you believe in that. So if
as the therapist,
yes, therapist. No, just generally as a person.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So if you believe in the demonic, or if you believe in the spiritual world, I think America is because of the Bible Belt and the way churches are there, and you get lots of mental health practitioners and psychiatrists that are Christian and believe in the demonic, so they do what we call deliverance or inner healing. So there's an integration of counselling and spiritual kind of support, or they will focus just on the deliverance, so they will cast out the demon, exorcism, whatever you want to call it, and then they will move them on to a psychotherapist, a trained mental health professional. In the UK, it's quite different. We don't necessarily have that. So it is very much like, it's either you don't believe it or not. The medical community probably don't believe that. The DSM, but don't necessarily believe that, but they put that under cultural context, as in it's culturally akin to what maybe people in Pentecostal churches, for example, believe, or people from Africa or certain countries or islands in the Caribbean, etc. So as a therapist, how I would deal with it, because I've come from that background, and I know what I believe, I would believe them. Now, what I would say is, as I believe them, I believe their story.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, okay, they've said that they, so-and-so says that they're depressed, demon-possessed. Do you feel that demon-possessed? Depending on what they say, then what I will do, how I respond. Psychosis, partly because, again, I've come from that church background, I can tell the difference personally. I can tell the difference between someone who is saying a cultural belief of, I feel like I'm demon-possessed, or I know my family's trying to poison me, and then someone that is psychotic. But because I come from that culture where I've got aunties and uncles that believe that, but they're quote unquote not mentally unwell.
Yeah.
Then you meet people that are saying that person is poisoning me. And the reason I say it's simple, it's all to do with the reality check. If a person believes somebody is doing juju, as we know, or voodoo, you don't go around shouting and screaming about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So by that point, if someone is coming to you, if professionals are coming to you, I'm coming to do a mental health act assessment, most likely to either decide whether you're going to be detained in hospital under section 2 or 3 of the mental health act, you're not going to sit there and tell me my cousin's doing juju on me. You would know, okay, I'm not going to say that to you.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, you're probably unwell at that time, you're not able to determine reality, you're not able to kind of caution yourself, it just comes out because that's what you believe in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So If someone comes to me, it also depends. Is that distressing you? That may not be distressing them. They could just disagree with that point of view, or it could be distressing them. Right. So it depends on what they present with. There's people that will come to me and say, I know I caused the death of my child. Or I know I caused the death of my husband. Why? Because, you know, family says this. It doesn't have to be anything like supernatural. Or it just could be like, oh, you know, because I always do this thing every single day. I didn't do it that day. Something went wrong.
Right.
That's something we call magical thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people have magical thinking. It's quite a normal thing. Then you've got the extremes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm saying that I believe in that. But when someone presents with me, do they believe in that first? And how is that impacting them, distressing them?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of psychotherapists may not believe in that. And then how they may deal with it may just be like, oh, that's fake, that's not real. Again, it all depends on the client. That may help a client, that may not help a client. Sometimes they're insulted because you're saying that their faith is not real, because that's a big part of what they believe in their faith. So I think it's about not trying to assume anything and just trying to follow what the client says. Okay, so do you think you're demon-possessed? What does that mean? What does demon possession mean for you in your cultural context or in your religious context? And what does it mean for you now? Do you feel like you're being controlled? You know, all of these questions to understand that person's context. But I think I really wish if there were more Christians doing this. I think there are, but more of us frontlining this, because I think there needs to be bridging that gap between the spiritual and the medical. It shouldn't be a separation, because many people are spiritual, so it's not something that's like, oh, spiritual, ugh, no, we only can deal with what we can see. You know, we don't understand mental illness. It's a very subjective thing. One psychiatrist can say you're schizophrenic, another says bipolar.
Well, this is my point, because I'm kind of glad you've brought that up as well, because it's like, if you have a white middle-class female therapist who has a client who says, you know, I'm being possessed, you know, it's been confirmed by my church, and, you know, sometimes I act out in a certain way, and let's just say they break out into speaking tongues. Now, how you're going to handle that would be very different. Do you see what I mean? So, I mean, I know you can't speak on behalf of another therapist who's not you, but it's like, what could come of that for someone who isn't culturally in tuned to their client? You know, could a white female or white middle class therapist think that person's just, they've lost it, like, they're at the end of the road?
Potentially. I guess a good therapist wants to understand the context their client is in. A good therapist wants to ensure they can manage the risk, and that they and the client are safe. But in all honesty, a therapist has their own prejudices. It's about how you kind of not allow that to influence a relationship, and then allow that individuality of that person to shine through. So, you know, my therapist is a white middle class woman. I'm a black woman, maybe from a working class background. I'm of faith. She's of faith as well. Differences. And she's interested in my experience. Doesn't necessarily agree or doesn't necessarily believe everything. I don't say believe, but doesn't necessarily believe it in its existence, but believes me. That's what's important. I don't need her to believe that well, she does, but I talk to God. Whether she did or did, that's not important to me. If she believes in God, it's important if she believes me that I talk to God and that I'm not crazy. So that's what I think. As long as the integrity of the relationship is kept, I think it's okay. But you touched on a cultural point. Many probably won't understand that. I always say this, and this does, and this is just probably my interest. I remember in my first year of psychotherapy, we had to write what type of clients we wouldn't work with. And a number of people wrote they wouldn't want to work with an evangelical Christian. And I found that very interesting. And again, it was only one time, but then the appetite of psychotherapy, and I wrote that in one of my research papers, there's when there is talk about religion or faith, I feel like it's done in a very, if not up or down way, like the people that have faith, you know, it's not seen as valid, I feel. What's more validated, probably more Buddhism because of the mindfulness and meditation, but the Judeo-Christian faith, I don't think is as valued or valid in psychotherapy. But it's understandable because a lot of the great fathers of psychotherapy, Jung, Freud, were were anti-religion.
Oh, I see. Right.
So it seeps through in my, you know, in my personal opinion. Without saying I've researched every single founder, but I know what's it called? Freud was a Jew, as in culturally Jew, but didn't practice as a Jew. Definitely Byrne from transactional analysis. I'm not sure about Jungian. But a lot of the founders of a modern day psychotherapy were kind of anti-religion. So it's not impossible to understand why psychotherapists, of course, will be very vacant of faith. So I say that to go into then when you meet a white middle class person, they could have a bias towards people that have faith. From what you see on TV, someone speaking on tongues, jumping up and down. It seems crazy, isn't it? I'm used to it. You're probably used to it. Part of our culture. But if you're not part of that culture, you might think, what the crap are they doing? So when you've got a person that he seems respectable, comes in and says, yeah, I speak in tongues, I talk to God, I see demons, you're thinking, whoa. So I would say most a good therapist should be able to say, this is quite unusual for me. Now, I'm just really curious about that. What's it like growing up believing in demons? Because I don't believe in anything. I just don't see. What's it like?
But then isn't that? But that's then wasting my time. Like as a client, as a client, then because I feel like that's wasting my time. Because if I've got now, because I say to my listeners, because this is catered for predominantly a black audience, right? I say to my listeners, try and find a therapist who is the same colour as you or culturally in tune with you, because it saves a lot of conversation. So, for example, when I was having therapy with my last therapist, I specifically sought out a black woman. And to my luck, I managed to sort out a black woman of Jamaican heritage. So when I was having conversations with her, there were certain things I just didn't have to explain because I could say it and she gets it straight away. Whereas if I now have to sit there and explain this to you and you don't get it, I kind of feel like when I'm having my sessions, I'm looking at the time, okay, £1.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't got time to be explaining stuff like that to you. Do you know what?
No, that makes sense. So that is important. There is that sense of, for some people, because I think, you know, it depends on the need that you have. For some people, they actually quite like that. Oh, someone's asking me questions, because it goes to their need of not feeling important or not thinking they matter. Someone actually asking about your faith or your culture is that I actually matter to you. What I have to say is important. For other people like yourself, it's like, look, that part needs to be understood. I want to get to the meat of the matter, you know. So I think, you know, it does depend on the relationship you have with the therapist and also where you're at. You might be like, I ain't got the time to be explaining. Or for some people, they might actually like that. And also, it could also just feel like you might think that person would never understand. Or maybe you feel, you know, it could be embarrassing. Or like you said, it could just take long to get to the meat of the matter. So I do agree with you that potentially, and I say that, it is likely to be be easier. However, that could also be a negative thing because you can make assumptions already as a therapist.
That's true.
And I may not ask certain questions because I already know what you're saying. Now, I may not challenge in a certain area because I think like that or I get that. So, you know, that the over-familiarity, in the relationship. So I think it's about you. If you feel like I need someone that looks like me to represent me, to mirror me, to have at least a basic understanding of my struggle, of my cultural background. And of course, but you might be a person that's like, I just want to speak to somebody that's competent and who is willing to understand my context. And I think that's just as important. But I do think in this present day, it is important to have someone that does reflect your cultural background. But be aware, unfortunately, there's still not as many of us going into the profession. So if everybody went into therapy, which yes, we should, then there's going to be more people. The demand will be higher than the supply, basically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So some of us will have to be okay and comfortable, potentially, with a non-black therapist because there's just not as many out there as we would like there to be.
Interesting. So can you talk to us about the process let's say I make the decision that, yes, I'm going to start therapy, you know, how long should I be looking to have sessions for, at a minimum, would you say?
Okay, so just to quickly say, for most people, when they say they want therapy, they end up going to their GP. Their GP points them to IAPT. IAPT is Integrated Access of Psychological Therapies. It's an NHS-based therapy, and it is primarily based on CBT, so Cognitive Behavioural Therapy, and a very short-term therapeutic option, and it's primarily based on your cognition and your behaviour and how it's impacting you in the present day. You're not going to be exploring past that much, and it is very workbooky to a degree. You know, you do homework and stuff. And for some people, they like that. They want to know what they want to do. This is an issue and deal with that. And there's a waiting list for that. So each area will have their waiting list. You can either be referred by your GP or refer yourself. And independent on their waiting list, then you may or may not get seen, depending on the severity of your presentation. Now, for a lot of people, they either do it, want more, or just don't want to wait. So they seek outside, you know, so that could be private therapy with a therapist or a counsellor that has their private practice. And you can see a person within a week. You can call them up and then meet them. Now, that's a cost to it, because on average, most private therapists range between 50 to 70, but could even be 100, all depending on what the individual decides to charge, or sometimes the particular modality. You know, maybe some modalities are more expensive, like DBT, or a psychologist, because of their doctorate, the psychologist, they're going to charge a minimum £100 per session. So, but if funds were, an issue, money was an issue, you can do that. You can literally do it tomorrow. Go seek for a therapist, say, I'm interested, and you have an initial session tomorrow. So it can happen as quick as possible, but usually money's an issue for most people. So then they look at what we call the third sector, and that's where frontline therapist comes in, which is low-cost counselling. And that, on average, depending on when you book your assessment and have it, can take a couple of weeks to maybe maximum a couple of months, because again, there could be a waiting list to book an assessment. But it's meant to be faster than NHS, because there's usually a quicker turnaround in the sense that there's more people that can provide the provision than what they have maybe in the NHS. And it's at a cheaper cost. But then you still have the people that can't afford that at all. So you will have the people that can't afford £20 per session, etc. So it all depends on the route you go down. You could have therapy tomorrow. If you really wanted to, you can go on Counselling Directory, Psychology Today, and we'll look for a therapist in your local area, contact them at their nearest availability, and book. You can go to NHS, and that could be various time between 6 to 8 to 12 to weeks to even 3, 4, 6 months, even a year.
Okay.
Then third sector organisations can be a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, again, dependent on the demand that they have. Right now with frontline therapists, it's usually just about a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So if you book a session, you'll be assessed, and then you'll be matched with a counsellor who is normally training. So most third sector charities, the reason why it's affordable is because the counsellors and the psychotherapists and the psychologists are getting what we would call clinical hours. So they are in various stages of their training, so that's what makes it lower, because they're not qualified yet. So it's a bit of a give. You might have to say, okay, I may not get a qualified one, but I'm still getting someone that I can talk to, who's being supervised. Every therapist should be supervised if they're seeing clients, and who's under clinical management of the training that they're in, training institute, and of the actual organization. But you're paying at a lower cost. You know, so those are the things that people think about as well, have to contemplate. If they're going to go for something on a lower cost, it might not be qualified. But that shouldn't take it away as well, because that person is the relationship being built between the individual and the client. All research kind of indicates it's not really what modality, CBT, person-centered, integrative, it's the relationship being built. And if you build a robust working alliance, be it a trainee or not, that is what heals. Is that relationship? It's meeting those unmet needs. It's unraveling those the trauma, the wars that are being brought up. It's managing that trauma. That is what's important. Mm. And you can do that with a trainee who is being supported to support you, because every therapist is being supported to support you, because they must have someone usually more qualified than them supervising them. Mm-hmm. So you're not even in this journey by yourself, actually. You're seeing your therapist who either has their own therapist, but definitely has their supervisor. So in a good way, you're not just being seen by that person. Information is not being shared like
shared,
that.
Yes,
the person is being supported to support you. And I think that's an amazing thing. Mm. So I hope that helps. I hope that's not too complicated. But it's just to show you that there are kind of different routes. And funding, money is usually the biggest factor. If you have money, like anything, you can literally start tomorrow.
Yeah. Mm.
But because money is usually a factor, or even if you do have the money, you've got so many bills. You know, you've got all of these different things that say, like, I want therapy, but I've got to pay my light bill, for example. You know, the first sector, frontline therapists and other services like Mind are there to really meet the need, that the demand that NHS can't currently meet.
Mm. So when you say you come in for an assessment, what does that involve and what does that look like?
A bit like how we're talking now to a degree, but more direct questions about why, what brought you to therapy, and just to give a context of why you're here, because it just helps to, usually the assessor you don't meet again, and the assessor's not involved ongoingly in your sessions. It really is just to tell the therapist, this is the person that you're going to meet, and for them to get an insight of you before they meet you, and that's it. Mm-hmm. But it also allows the person to ask questions and understand what the process is about, because a lot of people that I have found coming to frontline therapists haven't had counselling before and don't actually know. They're just like, they heard about it and thought, I want to do counselling, I'm going to do it. So it gives them a kind of an insight to what, you know, what they get, what they're going to have. And I think it just answers a lot of questions, and it's comforting and reassuring that a service is relatable to them, because, you know, Mind is an amazing charity, but many of us don't go Mind because it's not in our faces. We just see it on the street. We see the shop, you know, selling gloves, right?
Yeah.
So, and unfortunately, I've learned that GPs don't really recommend things that's not on the NHS because of, you know, lawsuits and stuff like that. Some GPs will say, you know, go Mind or go to frontline therapist, but a lot of GPs won't. So all you would know is IAP. You have to probably do scrolling on Google. But I think with my service, because it's in Instagram, and I think there's research that says a lot of particularly Black people get a lot of information now from Instagram, I think it's a relatable service than like what you think a counselling service could be run by, maybe like an old white man or old white lady. You just think, you know, how would they understand my life, for example? But a counselling assessment is a conversation. You know, assessment makes it formal, but it really is a conversation about why you're here. You may come and be like, man, I need to be here. I don't need to be here. Or I come and say, I'm not ready. Or you may come and I say, not suitable, you need to go to IAPT, or you need to go back to your GP and ask to go to secondary care services because you need more help. So the assessment is to assess suitability and your willingness, give you a insight into what is to come, and just to make sure whoever's coming into the service, it's safe for them and for the trainees as well. Cause that's really important, because if I got someone who was self-harming every single day, calling the ambulance, going to hospital, I probably wouldn't be able to, I could see them because I'm experiencing that, but I wouldn't give it to any of my trainees. Not because they're training, but the service doesn't manage that. We're not a multidisciplinary team. They, you know, they probably need to be managed within a multidisciplinary team, mental health team that can manage that level of unpredictability.
Right, okay.
You know? So sometimes it's to do with competence, not that a person is not competent enough, but the structure doesn't allow us to work in that way. You know, like, I couldn't necessarily do someone that's hangover, you know, but there's agencies that can work with people that, you know, deal with drug and alcohol. But if you're constantly using and putting syringes, like, it's, there's a level of management we can't manage, because we're not a service catered to that. So that's what the assessment is there for, to just kind of make sure who's coming through the door, to ensure that we are able to support them, and also my trainees can work with them.
Okay, so you've had your assessment, everyone's happy, we're going to go ahead. So the first session then, so, you know, do you come in and lie on a couch?
Unless it's psychoanalysis. Different modalities. I think in some of the therapy rooms there could be couches if someone wants to lie down. But no, generally speaking, you're sitting down. You're sitting in front of a person, and it's usually lasts 50 minutes, so 5-0, so an hour, but it's 50 minutes exactly. And the first session probably is establishing the frame, going through the contract, saying, okay, you're going to meet here every week. This is the cancellation policy. What's it called? This is the how you can contact me. You know, all of those things to establish the frame, you know, confidentiality, etc., etc., to make the person feel safe, to make the person feel secure, to make the person understand the framework they're in. It's a different relationship. It's not your teacher, it's not your friend, it's not your partner. It's a very different relationship. Some people don't mind going, hey, that's my therapist. Some will be like, if I see you road, you don't know me.
Know me.
Exactly. So it's kind of establishing who am I to you in this moment, and also potentially outside, because it's a small community.
Yes.
You mm-hmm. have to remember, particularly if you want someone that looks like you, you could be seeing them at your family cookout, you could be seeing them at a cultural event like that. So that's always something to bear in mind.
Yes. Do you know what, it's funny you say that, because I met with a friend for lunch and he was saying that he'd been seeing a therapist, and he soon found out that they shared the same mutual friend, and he had to stop seeing him, because not that he didn't trust him, but it was like, I'm seeing you more on a social basis, and it just made him feel very, very uncomfortable.
Of course.
And so he kind of left that kind of situation. But yeah, that's a very good point.
Particularly in London, it's not America where it's massive and big states, you know. So that's something to do and bear in mind. I know with mine, because it's white middle class, we don't run in the same circles. You know, there is no way I'm going to see her. Mm-hmm. But yeah, potentially. If you were going to some of cultural, maybe, and depends on the age as well, but yeah, you could see them, and they could be related, but like, what, 2 or 3 degrees apart from each other? So it's just something to bear in mind, and that's what we talked about in the first session, like, what would it be like if you saw me outside? It's about preserving that contract. And also, it depends on what you bring. You know, there's some clients that are more needy than others, so they want you to be their friend, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Okay.
It's about establishing that boundary that I am not your bedroom. Don't call me outside of these hours. You know what I mean? Because some clients will do. They may call you at 12 midnight, but I'm having a crisis. And it's about establishing that. You know, the psychotherapeutic relationship is so interesting. What comes out in that relationship sometimes is like what we would say, what we'd call regression, when you go back to childlike states, again, unconsciously. So it's happened that you send a text and maybe it was very like straightforward, meet tomorrow. And that could offend the client, feel like that sounds very judgmental or harsh. These are things that we talked about. And some people are like, that's a bit weird. But these things happen within the room, because maybe all your life people have spoken to you quite abruptly. So in that moment, you've been taken back to the past, and those feelings came up. So it's the first couple of sessions, not just the first session, is really about establishing that frame. And you're building what we call the working alliance. Part of you is like, can I trust you? Because who are you? Like, what? How am I going to come and just tell you all my business? Some people are like that. People will come, oh my God. But a lot of people are guarded. You're cautious. You're thinking like, what can you handle? What can you take? This is usually unconsciously, but sometimes it is consciously. And that is what's happening in the first few sessions. It's really about you testing and kind of saying, can you handle what I'm going to bring? Because you're thinking, can I even handle what I'm going to bring?
Yeah.
You know, so I need to make sure you can handle what I'm going to bring. When I break down, can you contain me? Are you going to judge me for what I'm going to say? These are all the things that are likely going through a client's mind. And then for a therapist, it's also, I want to understand you. I want to get your context. I want to know your background. I want to know what's important to you. I want to know what, you know, I want to know the level of uncomfortability you can take. I want to know what we determine psychologically minded. How able are you to reflect on yourself? How able are you to introspect? Those are the first few sessions. But it obviously is really important about that frame, that boundary. You know, if you come in, if you've got an appointment at 7, end at 7:50. If you come at 7:30, end at 7:50. Money's where lots of games get played. It's like, why should I pay you for this? Or, you know, you keep missing payments. What's going on there? Why are you missing payments? Why are you always telling me you owe me? You know, what is going on there? That's where you see a lot of psychological games, what we call it, psychological games, unconsciously happen when it comes to money or ending. Sometimes like, why have we got to end now? Like, why can't we continue? Or why is it that with this client you always continue, you end just before 7, you're rushing with your next client coming in? What is going on there that you cannot end? You know, why are you always late? or why are you like half an hour on time? Like, you know, where are you, there's nowhere for you to stay. Like, why are you outside of my house half an hour before session? All of that is the therapy. All of that is about exploring. It all means something. So the first few sessions is about testing the relationship. But you're doing that throughout, really. But those few sessions is making you feel comfortable, making you feel safe, and making sure that both of you know what you're working. What is this relationship? And also the goals. Can't forget that. What's your expectation? In 6 months' time, you know, where do you want to be? What are you presenting with? In terms of how long... I always say at a minimum 6 months, because I don't know what, unless you're coming for a very specific thing, I want to be confident, okay, maybe 6 weeks, 12 weeks, but if you want to explore things,
yeah,
what's 6 weeks going to do? By the time 6 weeks come, you just got it started, because you're just now opening up, because sometimes you spend a lot of time saying, this is my days, what I'm doing, before you can really, really go deep. So 6 weeks, what's that? 12 weeks, what's that? You're just, this is talking something that you do not know. We don't even chat to our friends about deep stuff until you know them for years, let alone a therapist.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you've got to think about it like that. You're building a different relationship, but a relationship. So it takes time. So I would say minimum 6 months, but a solid year is a good baseline to say, do I do another year, do I do another 6 months? Or, you know, I think I've got, I've done something okay for a year. But I would say minimum at least 6 months to really explore anything in sufficient depth. But I will not negate short-term therapy. That's all you can afford, or all that's provided for, because
something's better than nothing.
Exactly. Any therapy is good therapy if it's done well.
Okay. So, let's say we've got someone who's listening who, you know, just feels like they, you know, just maybe has some like low self-esteem issues. They, you know, they may be struggling at work. Why would they need to go to therapy? Like, how could you help them?
First and foremost, therapy isn't when something is wrong. Therapy, you can just go to therapy like you want to just do a checkup. You want to know what's going on. It's good to talk to somebody. This is my motto. If you've been living on this earth and you ain't dealt with your issues, how much longer can you say, I'm going to deal with it? You ain't dealing with it. Be it self-esteem, be it confidence. Sometimes you need a third person. That's how I see. If you were dealing with your issues, you would be dealing with it. Many of us are not dealing with our issues. So how much longer can you go on telling yourself that it's going to get dealt with when it's not being dealt with? So I would say, as soon as you think of going to therapy, and if you can, if you have the means to do it, and if not, then you've obviously got IAPT on the NHS. Go talk about it. You know what, if you go and you do a good 6 to 12 sessions and you think, I ain't got nothing to say, then at least you say you've tried, you've spoken to somebody. But usually there is something to say. A good therapist and a good relationship can bring something out, and it's a good way to talk, you know, talk out some things that's in your head. You know, sometimes we just think in our head a lot. Talk it out, let someone else hear it and go and mirror that and go, that's a really good idea, or that doesn't really make sense, or what's going on there, why do you react like that? And also, if you're not good at reflecting, if you're not good at being introspective, it helps to have another person there, because a lot of people are not good at reflecting. It's always like, that person did that and that person did that, but what did you do? Oh, I didn't do nothing. The other person can kind of say, well, you know, what was going on there? You know, why did you react like that? You know, they only said that. What took you to that place? So I think if, you know, like you said, low self-esteem, those are all good reasons to come. Even if you ain't got low self-esteem, even if you're the most confident person in the world, you know, talk to somebody about it. About what's going on in your head. I do not believe that nobody doesn't have anything, something that nigs them in their mind. It all depends how you manage that. Some people are good at managing it, and fair enough. But I think for most people, it bugs them. They put it aside, they put away, suppress it. So I think in that instance, when you realize that, this thought always goes in my mind, I'm not worth it, I'm not good enough, I'm not going to get this job, I'm not really good at talking to people, I can't manage my employees, I'm not a good employee, talk to somebody about it. It doesn't have to be deep. You're not going to someone like, I've got a major issue. It could just be like, I'm not confident at work. And then we can explore your confidence. And next one, that goes down to something really, really deep. Or may not be. Some people have okay childhoods. We've also got to say that not everyone's got a traumatic childhood. But you may have had a traumatic adult life, the death of a loved one, or, you know, losing a job, etc., etc. So it isn't to say you've got to have a traumatic childhood. I've assessed quite a few people, actually. And they're like, oh, so how's your childhood? Oh, really good. And I'm like, okay, explore. Esther is a really good childhood, but I'm here because I just want to just make sure that my mental well-being is in optimum. Mm-hmm. I said, what? Look at that. You're literally just coming. There ain't any issues, major issues in your life. It's literally just, I want to make sure that no issue creates because of nothing that I've not resolved. So I think I would say that, do that. You know, if you're listening to the sound of my voice and you think, you know what, I haven't got anything major in my life, but I want to talk to somebody about, you know, my life. Do it. If you've got something major, I would still encourage you to as well. Please reach out. Look, we don't want to spend 5 years, 10 years regurgitating the same issues, regurgitating the same problems. Mm-hmm. We want to be new and brand new people every year. We want to change and evolve. But you can't change and evolve when you've got things weighing you down.
Yeah. So what about those people who don't think they have a problem though? So like, so for example, in the example I gave of myself, so I had no idea that I was in an emotionally abusive relationship, because for me, emotionally abusive means you're ugly, you're this, it's someone constantly putting you down. So I didn't think I had an issue until this, like I say, this blog post came my way.
Yeah.
So for someone who's listening, who's like, well, I'm all right, you know. How do you reach somebody like that? And guys, look, this isn't this particular episode isn't an ad to just primarily promote frontline, you know. Isn't. But do you know what I mean? It's not that's not the reason. Like, you know, you guys should know by now, my intentions for you listeners who keep coming back every week, my intentions are good. But like I say, for someone like me who didn't think, I mean, there are probably certain things in my life that I could probably pull out and be like, oh, I could go therapy. But it was this particular thing. I was like, wow, like, I'm not even aware of how I'm behaving, because this has all been so normalized for me. So how what would you say to somebody who can't see?
If you have anybody that has said to you to go therapy, or has told you you've got an issue, and you at least somewhat trust that person, you think they love you, listen to that person. We can't see our blind spots.
Yes, blind spots.
I don't know if anyone saw it. There's actually a thing that went viral of a big lorry dragging a car.
The car, yesterday.
With the blind spot.
Yeah.
You know.
And the man's like, I literally didn't see.
Because I've been in a car where it's hit. The truck hit, like nothing major, but he couldn't see because it's so high up they can't see. That's why when I'm driving past them, I drive fast past them.
Because
I'm like, the way they're swerving.
Same.
There are blind spots. We all have blind spots, you know. I could be doing this interview if you think it's good, and then when I hear it back, go, why did I say that? You know. And I think, be willing to hear people. If you haven't got anybody that you can trust and tell you, and that's the issue. That is an issue. So if there is nobody around that you can say, well, I ain't got no problems, and no one's told me I ain't got problems, and I don't even trust them to tell me that anyways, then that's an issue. That means there's something going on in your friendship where you can't find someone that you trust, or you haven't made trustworthy friends. So if you have people or loved ones that have told you you have issues, I don't mean you have you are the issue, but you just got issues, maybe you're impatient or whatever it is, so go seek it out. And if you haven't got that, seek it out, because everybody has issues. There is no one in this world that hasn't got issues. If you sit here and think you have not got an issue, then that likely is your issue. You're not aware of the issue that you have, because every single person now is about the depth of the issue. I do agree, it's about the severity, it's about how it impairs your life, and that I would agree. However, you could have an issue that might seem very small, but fester and grow.
Yes.
You have a lot of... they say that the depression in older adults is increasing. So, and they're from the generation that they suppressed everything, and they were like hard workers, and, you know, retired at 60-something years old, and was like, oh, what problems do you have? You know what we had when we were older? Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're getting depressed. So all of that they suppressed hit them in their older age. A lot of people, when they retire, they die because of the impact of not working. So don't wait until you're 60, 70, realizing, oh gosh, I did have all of these issues. So I would say, check up. go to an assessment. It doesn't have to be frontline therapist, but go to somewhere, talk about it. If the therapist says that maybe this is not the right time for you, then you know maybe it's not the right time. At least you tried and checked it out. Yeah. Because I am of the opinion, and maybe I'm very few. Not everybody needs to go therapy, but it shouldn't be a forced thing. It really should be a thing that you want to go therapy, because it works better. It just works better. Mm. And if you don't think you need it, then probably you don't need it at that time.
Mm.
There could be an issue, but I will tell you this for free, is that when what they say, sugar, honey, iced tea hits the fan, you'll be seeking a therapist. But you could have done it before that and not have as much sugar, honey, iced tea.
Yes.
You know? So that is what I would say. I would say, like, look, don't wait until there's a major issue. Just go and check it out. If you have 6 sessions and they say to you, there ain't not much to say, like, you know, this is okay, then that's fine. You had a little bit of a checkup. Therapy should be seen as a checkup. Go and check up.
Yeah.
There may not be a major issue, then you've done a checkup. The same way you go to your GP, you have an annual check. Ain't nothing wrong. You don't come back until there's something that you need to check up again. Mm. I think it should be the same, like a cervical score screening. Go and check up your mental health, your well-being. How are your thoughts? You know, are you thinking positively? Are you thinking affirmatively? Or are you thinking quite negatively? That's what I would say.
Okay. Love. Laid. Bare.
Yeah, I think one of the only things I would like to say, if I can say it very succinctly, is that mental health, everyone has. Mm-hmm. A mental illness is what we would call a divergence from mental health. So something has happened that is not what we would call, unfortunately, say normal, quote unquote. So I'm doing, you know, those quote unquote fingers. But we all have mental health, and that physical health. Sometimes you've got backache. Sometimes you've got you hurt your hand. Sometimes you break a bone. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes you get a disease, and it's the same as a mental health. It's a journey. You, unfortunately, most of us can't go through life being unscathed. Something is going to happen, whether it's the death of a loved one, a breakup in a relationship, whatever it is, meaning that we all have stuff that we carry. And for some of us, it weighs us down more than others. And some of us, we kind of, you know, just get on with it. And I think I just want to encourage people that are listening that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a journey. Take each day as it comes. And, you know, build yourself one at a time. It's not a mental illness is not a life sentence.
Yes.
Depression, anxiety, yeah. Schizophrenia, bipolar. You know, society has not caught up yet to accept it. We've got to force them to accept it by living your life, standing in your truth, and taking each day as it comes, and more people coming on podcasts like this to talk about their experiences. So I would just want to encourage everyone to say that, you know, I'm standing with you, because obviously this wasn't a session to talk about myself, but, you know, I've gone through depression, and it's a very, very complicated and unfortunately annoying condition, but you can get over on the other side. I'm a living testament to that. So just wanted to encourage you guys, and thank you for listening to the sound of my voice, and apologies to the long-windedness, but I hope I made sense, and I really hope people understood where I was coming from.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, so tell us about Frontline.
Frontline. So Frontline Therapist is a organisation that basically makes psychological therapies affordable. So if you are seeking counselling and want to talk to somebody, but think, you know, I can't really afford £50 a week, which is about £200 a month, but I can probably afford £30, £20, what have you. It's between £20 and £40 per session, and you can have it for as long as you like, or as less as you like. You may say, I only want it for a month. Then fine, you can have 4 sessions. You can say, I want to do it for 6 months. So it gives you, it puts you in the driving seat of your journey, being supported and facilitated by someone there to help you open up and explore yourself. So that's what Frontline Therapist is for. It's for anyone who feels that they want therapy but can't afford it. And of course, most especially, it's for my black women, my black men, my Asian women, Asian men that feel there isn't a service that thinks about them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't guarantee that every single person will be matched by a black or Asian therapist, because like I've mentioned, unfortunately, the demand for black and Asian therapists is more than the supply. Mm-hmm. But what I can promise you is that each therapist, or let's say each trainee, is is purposely in this organization intentionally to work with people from our community. They want to understand, they want to work, they want to work culturally sensitive. So yes, for some people that I don't want to explain, but for those that don't mind that, know that somebody is there to listen to you in your context and understand you in all that amazingness that you bring. So, you know, Frontline Therapist, you can get me on Instagram at Frontline Therapist, all one word. You can go on my website, www.frontlinetherapist.com. So Instagram, Twitter, frontlinethera1, for whatever reason they gave me that. and you can email me at hello@frontlinetherapist.co.uk. The easiest way, though, is probably to go through my Instagram if you have one, or just write Frontline Therapist. It's quite a unique name, so I'm going to come up if you don't know how to get the URL correctly. So Frontline Therapist. You'll find me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and of course my website. And you can even give me a call. It's on the website, and I will speak to you, and we can talk about your ideas and thoughts and feelings for counselling, if that's what you want to do.
Okay, fantastic. Well, Esther, thank you so much coming on to Love Lay Bear. She had a bit of a nightmare of a journey to come down. So, honestly, I'm so grateful. Love to have you on again at some stage. Yes. Maybe we can do some, maybe topic specific, you know, maybe we could maybe break down depression or anxiety or something one day. That would be quite good. So yes, I would love to have you on. So thank you so much. Guys, as always, we've covered a lot of things today, but obviously particularly in terms of therapy. I will be putting Esther's company details on the resources page. To be honest, this sounds like an amazing deal. What areas do you cover, I guess?
Okay. Fortunately, guys, not yet South London. That will be coming soon next year. But I do have Hackney. I have Islington. I have South Woodford. I have Haringey. But South London would come soon. But there are a lot of people that have come from South London. So if you're able to travel, you know, it is a sacrifice. Oh, and I have Wapping Shadwell. So that's kind of close to South London too. It will come in South London, but it's more North and East London. But a lot of people live in South, but they work other places. But if you want to contact me for other places in South London, I'm the type of person, I am not trying to monopolize. I refer a lot of people on. So you can, if you don't know, message me and I will find suitable low-cost counselling services and I'll just send them to you, because I'm not about come to Frontline Therapist, I'm about get help if you need it. So if you live far but you don't know where to go, because sometimes Google's just so much information, message me, DM me, I always respond to DMs, and I will refer you to appropriate services.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, guys, well, yes, you covered everything that I was going to say. But, you know, as always, if you are affected by anything we've spoken about, my DMs are always open, as is email. So if this is your first time listening, thank you very much for tuning in. This is Love Laid Bear. So you can find us at Love Laid Bear. Website is www.lovelaidbear.com. Twitter and Instagram is at Love Laid Bear. So you can contact me on any of those if you need to. Like I say, head over to the resources page. We've got a list of different support services, but like I say, I will put Frontline Therapists on there and on the blog as well. So yes, guys, it's been a very interesting talk. I've learned some stuff myself, actually. So yes, take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week, and I love you as always. So it's a wrap.
Love Laid Bear.
If you love this episode and know someone who could really benefit from hearing this talk, please share. And whilst you're there, leave me a review. I'd be forever grateful. Help me build awareness and raise consciousness one conversation at a time. Listen on Spotify, SoundCloud, Castbox, and Apple Podcasts.